fried egg requires a different technique. What you need to do is actually square the face so it'll dig down underneath that bad lie and propel that ball right out onto the green.
Here's the thing, playing out of a buried lie in a bunker is completely different than playing out of a nice, clean lie in a greenside bunker.
You need to be aggressive on any shot, whether it's sitting cleanly or it's a fried egg.
Well, we've all faced it, the dreaded fried egg. It's not to be feared, though. It's actually a pretty easy shot to hit.
Welcome back to another edition of Explorations, a fried egg golf podcast. Brendan, welcome on. We had quite the interview here for this episode.
It was quite the interview. It's a Northern Ireland's most famous, most successful, the greatest golfer in the history of that country. Rory McIlroy joined us. He joined us last Tuesday. I mean, this should be an evergreen podcast. Hopefully, if you know, the point of this Explorations feed is not just to give you our tales while we're there, while we were over there, but something to listen to if you were ever going to take a golf trip there. It's evergreen. But he, you know, joined us Tuesday of Players Championship Week 2024 to talk about our
trip. Might be a couple Players Championship takes in there.
He might refer to himself as the Prince of Pontevedra as he took the call from the castle itself. But it was great having him on. Obviously, it was great to get his time during such a busy stretch. One thing that became pretty apparent within our first 3 to 4 days was obviously how much Rory means to Northern Ireland, certainly Northern Ireland golf, and certain some of the clubs we went around to. So getting to talk to him about how much Northern Ireland means to him was really a valuable time. And I know you caught one, like it really impacted you at Ardglass there on like day two of our trip.
Yeah, I think obviously, I think it gets like a little lost. We think about Tiger Mania in America, and the U.S. is so big that Tiger has this like impact over, you know, across the country. You see Tiger memorabilia courses all over the place, but Rory grew up in such a small place. I mean, Northern Ireland would be a small state in the United States. And it's this, he has this massive, I mean, he's everything is seemingly at every golf course. And we were at Ardglass during, was the first round
Thursday
of Bay Hill?
Yep, Thursday Bay Hill.
And, you know, every time he hit a shot, the entire bar restaurant was fixated on the TV. It was crazy. It was just like, I don't think any American golfer has ever had that type of, even Tiger at his height of his powers wouldn't do that to a restaurant bar. Mm-hmm. Rory has this unbelievable gravitas in Northern Ireland.
There was like this Pavlovian trigger, like the Irish are very good at conversation and talking, and they'd just be having their meal or their banter at their table. And then you'd hear the name McIlroy from the television in the corner and everyone's head kind of simultaneously turned, and you picked up on it first. So just, I guess one more I'll add is our last night there. Our last night, we're in Portrush, and I won't say who, but someone affiliated with the club, we're kind of walking off, started telling us a story. It was like, I don't know if it's public, but Rory visited Royal Portrush when the course was closed. Only exempt players for the 2019 Open were allowed to play at that point. So getting close to the Open, obviously stuff's going up, grandstands are up. And he came driving around the corner and he talks about that drive, making it in this podcast, making it as a 10-year-old, the first time he ever visited. But this story was about modern time, more recent. And the storyteller told us he came around the corner, and this is as a 20-something for the 2019 Open, and started to well up when he saw the same vision, the same drive he'd made when he was 10, now with the Open Championship having come home. And there's these grandstands and TV towers on this tract of land he'd seen and known since he was a kid in his country. And then he went into the pro shop and they started talking to him like, can they get you anything? He started telling the story of coming around the corner. He started welling up, tearing up in the pro shop. He just asked for a coffee with, I don't know who's some of the women or whoever was in the pro shop, started welling up telling the story. Because to Portrush, if they were like, Rory was not mainly, but significantly responsible for driving the RNA to bring the Open back to Northern Ireland. And clearly you could see via the story how much it meant to see that massive infrastructure, like it's real. This is happening. And that was sort of in the weeks preceding it. So just another anecdote we heard while we were on the road. One thing with this feed is like Andy and Cameron and Matt are certainly well equipped to give you a ton of golf course insights wherever they are. But we wanted to talk to voices who lived there. A lot of times, I think with some of these tourism things, you'll get Americans sort of imposing their take or impression on a place they were at for 4 days or whatever. But hopefully with some of the interviews, and this is with the big one, you get a take of someone who knows it well. So that it, Andy? You got anything else you want to add?
Yeah, big thanks to Rory. And here's Rory McIlroy.
All right. Rory, welcome to the Explorations Podcast. First off, we are recording this on Tuesday of Players Championship Week. So we have to ask you, what is the real green Emerald Isle? Is it 17th at Sawgrass in the overseeded TPC Sawgrass, or is it where we are, the island of Ireland?
I don't know if I've ever seen a greener place on Earth. They say that the Phoenix Open's the greenest like place on Earth, but this is... They have went to town with the overseed this week. Like, they have went all out. I've never seen the rough as thick or as lush. It's like, I can't... Like, it's actually insane how much, like, thick grass there is everywhere. So they've had the fertilizer out, but hopefully as it dries out, it gets... they can start to mow it down a little bit. But it's... It's green here. It's probably a little greener than where you guys are, which is surprising.
It's got to be. I feel like Sawgrass overseeded is the furthest thing from Lynx golf in Ireland that there is, you know?
Yeah. I mean, this morning it's still so soft. I mean, they need to get the sub air on the greens. I was hitting 7 irons into greens this morning that were backing up 15 feet. It's like, it is so soft. So thankfully they can hopefully, you know, put the sub air on and they can get these things. There's no rain in the forecast, so there's no reason why this place shouldn't be a little firmer and faster by the tournament days. But yeah, it is, yeah, from where you guys are and what I grew up with, it's a far departure from that.
Let's talk about that. You now are a father. I'm curious if you could contrast kind of the golf culture that you grew up with in Northern Ireland with the golf culture in America that you see now for kids.
Yeah, I definitely think that coming from my part of the world, the golf culture is a lot more inclusive. Like I joined Hollywood Golf Club as a junior member at 7 years old, and I think my mom and dad paid £100 a year for me to be a member. You know, in the summers they ran junior competitions every Tuesday, every Friday. There wasn't an issue with getting access to the course. Yeah, there were certain times during the week that juniors couldn't play, but we had ample access to getting on the golf course, and I sort of contrast that with... I think there's a lot of great programs in America in terms of getting kids into playing golf, whether it's youth on course or first tee or PJ Tour Junior League. Obviously you guys just did a piece on the park, which I think is, you know, if the park in West Palm could be replicated 100 times around the country, I think that would be amazing for junior golf in the United States. But there's definitely just I think there's still an accessibility issue in the United States compared to where I grew up. And, you know, my oldest friends are the friends that I grew up with at Hollywood Golf Club. And, you know, some of my fondest memories are playing golf until 10:30 at night in the summers with those guys because, you know, we could. And no one was yelling at us to get off the course or, you know, so it was, felt like it was just a lot more accessible and inclusive as golf, you know. I think golf is getting better in this country, but I still think it's got a way to go.
What was it like, Hollywood, growing up at Hollywood Golf Club and Hollywood in particular, and those friends that you still maintain? I made a kind of an amateur comp to Arnold Palmer's Latrobe that I saw probably a decade ago, kind of this unassuming club that created these one-time, eventual golf superstars. What was that like growing up?
It was great. you know, my whole life revolved around that golf club. My dad worked there. As I said, all of my oldest friends, like Harry Diamond, who's my best friend and who's on my bag, has been on my bag for the last, whatever it is, 7-8 years. I met him on the putting green when I was 7 years old. And it was great. It was a fun place to play the game that I loved and to meet friends and to spend time with people that I became really close with. And, yeah, I think it had that culture of, you know, of inclusion. And, I didn't realize it at the time, but, you know, getting to this point in my life, I look back on those days and on those summers, and I really appreciate it because it helped me cultivate whatever talent I had in the game. And, you know, no one there in any way tried to hold me back or tell me that I wasn't old enough or I, you know, wasn't good enough, or, you know, I had a wonderful support system from that golf club that helped me, you know, improve and honestly get to the level that I got to.
I have like a lasting memory of my course that I grew up playing at, and it's like of riding my bike with my bag on the back. And I like always think about it. I would ride, I'd go over these train tracks and then I'd get there and they had this big putting green. We would spend hours, me and my buddies, on this putting green, like all day. We'd play 9 holes, but we might spend 3 hours on the putting green. Was there a place at Hollywood or a thing at Hollywood that you always think back to?
Yeah, so I would say the putting green was a bit, you know, I was always the youngest one there, and we always played to take golf balls each other. So like we'd be playing for, you know, someone would have a Turbolata in their bag and I'd play them for that on the putting green, or a professional 90, or, you know, when the Pro V1 came out, for example, or the Max Fly Revolution or the HT90, whatever it was, like you always like were playing people for their golf balls in the putting green, which was a lot of fun. And then the practice range was so far away from the clubhouse, and it was between the 13th and 14th holes in like this little valley. And it was only like 180 yards long, but it was only, I don't know, 20 yards wide. And every time you'd bring your practice bag down there, you would, like, every shot that you were practicing, like you were fearful of losing a golf ball. So, you know, I remember those days of like hitting 6 irons and 5 irons and like really putting yourself under pressure, because if you don't hit a good shot, you know, you're hitting it in the bushes and that golf ball's gone. So, and golf balls were such a valuable commodity when you're 10 and 11 years of age. So yeah, I've some really cool memories of the putting green at Hollywood and then that little practice range between 13 and 14. And then also, like, we probably shouldn't have been doing this, but we had a lot of fun, like, in the clubhouse and chasing ourselves around, like, locker rooms and having, you know, just getting up to stuff that kids get up to. But, yeah, so many great memories of that place.
I got to ask, did you learn how to hit it high because of the 10th hole?
I don't know. I think I've always had a I was a small kid and I'm still a pretty small guy, but I always had a tendency to like drop the club underneath and get it underneath the plane and get it behind me. And that helps you launch it up in the air. Like I just had to try to hit a high draw with everything because it was the only way I could get distance as a kid. And then that sort of stayed with me. But, no, you would think me growing up in that part of the world that I'd be able to, you know, flight the ball low and hit all these shots. And I've been able to do that at times in my career, but I've definitely been more comfortable hitting it high for some reason. But, and as well, like I think we'll probably get into this, but like today's technology, you don't really have to hit the shots that you once had to, especially on these golf courses. And obviously something that we all agree on, we'd love to see some of that come back into the game.
You talked a little bit about the support system you had at Hollywood, and obviously like your parents made a lot of sacrifices for you and the club did. We saw some of the investment you put into it a couple of days ago. There's a big gym, like fitness center, and then a bunch of TrackMan bays and things that you've helped foster or create. What is your current relationship like with your home, with your home club? What is it like now?
It's, you know, I don't, you know, unfortunately, I guess, like it's still home. It's the place that I grew up, but you know, I'm making my life elsewhere. You know, I haven't been home in over 2 years. I think COVID hasn't helped either. You know, I didn't get a chance to go back during COVID, but my last time there was in January 2022. So obviously with the Irish Open being back at County Down later this year, I'm looking forward to spending a little bit more time there. But it'll always be home. Like I don't want to ever lose the connection to the place that I grew up in. And I also want my daughter to know the place that I grew up in too, because I think that that's really important. She knows upstate New York pretty well because she's been there a lot more often than she's been to Hollywood, Northern Ireland. But, you know, hopefully in time she'll get to, you know, experience things there and start to spend a little bit more time there too.
You said you came back a couple years ago. How would you say that Northern Ireland's changed since you were a kid, and maybe using Hollywood as an example?
Yeah, so I think I felt very fortunate that I was, you know, Hollywood was always a pretty like, sort of affluent, like nice town to grow up in. We never really experienced the troubles or anything like that that some of the other areas of Northern Ireland did. So I was quite shielded from that, which was probably fortunate in some ways. You know, most of the bad stuff that I saw was on the news rather than with my own eyes. So I would say that Northern Ireland over the past, since the turn of the millennium, you know, over the past 20 years has become very, very progressive. And I think, you know, has sort of turned a new page or a new chapter in its history. I think Belfast is a pretty vibrant city. That's attracting international business.
I heard they got quite the food culture now.
Yeah, they've got the Cathedral Quarter in Belfast is really good. They've got I think a lot of people within the UK travel to Belfast for weekends and it's a cool, vibrant city. I haven't spent as much time there recently as I probably would like, but every time I go back, I'm always pretty impressed with the progression that it's made, especially, you know, since my childhood.
Speaking of progression, we were over at Portrush yesterday and we saw Fred Daly, right? His medal and the claret jug replica. It had been like 60 years, not like, it had been 60 years since anyone from the island of Ireland won a major. And now we've on this incredible run, right? With Patty, Shane, you, Graham, Darren. Do you feel like that? What is it? Was this just lightning in a bottle? Has the level raised competitively in the generation maybe preceding you, and you're sort of the youngest of that collection? How is it? I guess we've sort of been wondering, how do you get from junior golf here to major champion, and five of them happen in such short succession? It seems like such a different system, like you talked about, than America, a Scotland or Ireland, Northern Ireland. How do you get from here? Is that lightning in a bottle? And do you see that not maybe maintaining, but at least staying at a high level like that?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. I think when Padraig won his three majors in quick succession, I think it gave... it certainly gave GMAC belief, and it probably gave Darren belief as well, because, you know, I would say for the most part, Darren Clark up until that point maybe had a better career than Padraig. So I think it gave those two guys a lot of belief that if Padraig could do it, then they could go on and do it too. And then the big turning point was when GMAC won the US Open in 2010, because I would play every single Tuesday with him in practice rounds, and I would beat him 90% of the time. And I thought, well, if I can beat him 90% of the time on Tuesday, why, you know, he's just won a major. There's no reason why I can't win a major. And that's not the meaning of GMAC. Like, GMAC has had an awesome career, and, you know, his win at Pebble Beach in 10 was awesome. But it gave me belief in myself that I don't know that I had up until that point. And then I go on in 11 and GMAC is defending the US Open and I win at Congressional. And then I think we were sort of riding a wave of momentum at that point. Clarkie wins at Royal St. George's the very next major after that. And then obviously it's, I had my little run, and then Sheehan did what he did in 2019 at Portrush. And I think it happens, you know, if you look at the Europeans back in the late 80s and early 90s, I think it happened then with, you know, it was Seve, then it was Faldo, then it was Woozy, then it was Lyle, then it was Langer, and then it was Jose Maria. And it was like all these Europeans saw what the other Europeans were doing and were like, okay, if they can do that, I can do that too. And I think seeing your peers do these things gives you, maybe just gives you a sense of belief that you didn't know that you had.
Bulletin board material for Team Smash, maybe there with, yeah, with Graham. No,
don't worry, Brooks might be coming for you
in the locker room.
Yeah, I know. I don't want to. Yeah, I'm. I was going to say, you know, G-Max had a great career and he continues to have a great career. And I mean, who knows? He might have. I don't. I'm not keeping up too much with Smash GC.
One question I had for home, and then we'll get to some of the golf, is like, we were at Ardglass also, and that's where Michael Bannon plays. I was wondering for you since junior golf and now as a pro, how important is it for your coach to have a connection to your home, for a coach to have a connection, obviously, to your career? Is that important at all? Is it a comfort thing? How important is that in the grand scheme of things?
Yeah, so coaches are important, but I think coaches are more important because they need to know who you are as a person and how you receive information rather than, you know, who you are as a player. Like, you see it all the time out here. You know, guys will change coaches and they'll have like an instant bit of success. Like, that happens, but that, again, that goes back to just like every PGA Tour player is an amazing golfer. And if you give them just a little bit of belief that they're on the right path, they can go and they can win or they can play better again. But what happens is you get that quick uptick in performance and then you sort of regress back to your average. Like, that's, you know, I think Data Golf has like done some sort of studies on this as well. But I think it's way more important for a coach to know who you are as a person and how you receive information. Like, Michael knows that it needs to be my idea and he's very happy with it, you know, and that's on me. Like, that's me as a, like, I just need to feel like I own it. And maybe that's just me having a little bit too much ego or a bit too much, like a bit more of a control freak over it than I should. But he knows that I need to be the one in control of that. And if I'm not, and I feel like I'm being told what to do and it's not my idea, I don't respond to it very well. I actually shut down and then I don't. So I think having a coach that knows, like, Michael Bannon knows me since I was 7 years old. He actually knows me way, he's known me since I was born, but since we started to work together on golf, it's been, you know, we've been doing it together for 27 years. So he knows how I tick. He knows what I respond to, what I don't respond to. And I think that's super important in a player coach relationship.
Growing up, playing junior competitions, one of the things I've been taken aback about Ireland is just how competitive the golf is. Like, it doesn't feel like there's casual golf. It's just like every time they play, it is just like the knives are out and everybody's trying to win. And as a kid growing up, I always remember there were like tournaments you wanted to qualify for to play courses or competitions you wanted to play in. And it was like, oh, that's being held here. Is there a course in Northern Ireland that just stood above the rest? And if there was, what was it? And what are your early memories of playing maybe your first tournament there?
Yeah. So, I would say, yeah, the two that stand out are Portrush and Royal County Down, obviously. My dad brought me to play Portrush on my 10th birthday, and it was the first time that I ever met Darren Clark. I met him on the chipping green at Royal Portrush. And I think the one great thing about golf in Northern Ireland and in Ireland is a lot of these clubs hold open weeks. So it's not as if you have to wait to qualify for a competition that course to get to play it. They hold these open weeks, and if you enter early enough, you can go and play in their open stroke or open Stableford or whatever it is. So, again, just going back to the accessibility of the golf there, But I do. I remember like the north of Ireland is a big amateur championship that's played at Portrush every year. And that was all to do with the only way you could enter was if your handicap was low enough. So that was always the big goal in the summers, was to try to get your handicap down as low as possible so that you could enter the north. And my dad played in the north a lot. My dad was a decent amateur player, a good club player. Not really, like, he didn't really do much else, but he played in the north most years, and he actually was beaten by GMAC in the match play one year. But yeah, so like it sort of sounds a little incestuous, like how small it is, but it was a cool culture to grow up playing golf in. And I'd say the one golf course that maybe felt more out of reach than the rest was Royal County Down, because of the membership there and because it feels more like a, almost like a private American club compared to even like a Portrush. I think Portrush, maybe not so now because it's got so busy, as it's on the open road again. So, you know, the demand for playing there has gone up a lot over the last few years. But yeah, I've always felt like most courses in Northern Ireland have been super accessible, and you could really, if you really wanted to, you could go and play them.
That first time playing Portrush, so you're a kid, you've been playing your golf at Hollywood. Was there something that stood out about Portrush that you remember to this day?
Yeah, it was big. Like I remember I'd never played the course before, and you're driving on this little road, and then you get to the crest of a hill, and you're overlooking the entire golf course before you take the left to go down into Portrush. And I remember just looking at it going, this place, especially as a 10-year-old, it's like, this place looks absolutely huge, and the dunes are so high, and like everything just was like, it was a golf course but bigger, I guess. In my, you know, Hollywood's this tiny little, you know, piece of land on the side of a hill, and you go to somewhere like Portrush, and it's just like it's a completely different style and a completely different scene of golf that I hadn't really experienced before. So I just think how big everything was, and yeah, it was, you know, how deep the bunkers were, and you know, some of the, you know, even the hill up to the first green is like a big climb. And I don't know, it just to me, it just felt big.
It's funny, we were driving on that road down the coast. I'm like, it's kind of like dusk, it's very dark, it's like getting dark, and I'm just worried about keeping the car on the center line,
on the left side. Yeah.
And I, like, out of the corner of my eye, I like, right where you're talking about, I crested the hill, and I think I said to Brendan, I'm like, oh my god, look at those dunes over there, it'd be amazing if there was a golf course. And we drive like 100 more yards, and Brendan's like, I think that's Royal Portrush.
yeah. It's a pretty, you know, to put a golf course on that piece of land is pretty special.
You talked about your first time at Royal Portrush, and then Royal County Down feeling not maybe as easily accessible to you. What was your first time, your first memory of Royal County Down? What was your first impressions? How did you play? And what went through your head when you walked onto that course for the first time?
So I think the first time I was at Royal County Down, I didn't actually play. I was there to watch an inter-club match between, my dad was playing, but it was called the Barton Shield, which is like the big inter-club foursomes tournament. And I'm not sure what the other golf club was that they were playing, but I think the first time I was at RCD was to actually watch golf, not play. But I remember the first time that I did play, I was probably 13 or 14 maybe. And I just, it was the hardest golf course I had ever played. I remember going around going like, how could anyone break par around here? It's so difficult. You know, fortunately that was where my Walker Cup was. And that was always my like goal as an amateur, was like make the Walker Cup at Royal County Down in 07 and then turn pro after that. I had opportunities to turn pro before that, but I just so wanted to play the Walker Cup at home at County Down, and thankfully I was able to do that. And that was
quite the Walker Cup.
Yeah, it was stacked, especially the American team. And I mean, you know, there's a couple of studs, a few studs on the GB and I team as well. But yeah, it was a good team. Unfortunately, you know, the outcome wasn't what I wanted, but it was cool to be a part of.
So your first time, you're like, how do you play? How does anyone score around here? How has that relationship evolved with RCD? You've obviously been back. You played a competition there in Walker Cup. How has it evolved with RCD?
Yeah, so I think you just need to be, you know, at 13 or 14 years old. Like, I was a good golfer, but I was so raw and, like, didn't really know how to play the game. I knew how to hit golf shots, and I knew what to do, but, like, I didn't know that, okay, well, it's probably better to miss here, or, you know, like that tee shot on the fourth, the par three. It's like, it's sort of what you feel like if you don't hit that green, then you're dead, but it's like, okay, well, you know, this miss is probably better than that miss. And, you know, it's probably the first golf course that I played that I almost needed to think like one shot ahead of myself and sort of, you know, I think to me playing Royal County Down a lot helped me learn about how to be more methodical with my course management and be a little bit more disciplined as a golfer, I guess.
Is there a favorite hole or a favorite memory you have of RCD and all your loops around there?
I would say, so if you get the, it's a pretty unusual wind, but you can get the wind that's sort of coming like up over the mountains and like down, and it's like the fourth hole plays into the wind and the seventh hole plays into the wind, that little par three. And I remember like I've hit 3 iron into that seventh hole before. Like, where is this going to go? Like I've played that hole and I've hit it onto the 13th tee box. I've hit it like down the 8th fairway. It's such a cool little par 3. And that's, you know, I think 7's a very underrated hole on the course, and it's probably my favorite hole on the course because of that. I love a short, difficult par 3.
Dude, you still love it. Like, we were playing it, and the caddies said, they also might have told us that story of when you hit it left, right? Onto six. Yeah, six. What, as a pro, it feels like that short par three and the fall off in the back would drive them. The pros would not do well with that. The pampered pros would not do well with that.
Entitled pampered fucks. yeah, of course they wouldn't.
Is it still your favorite now that you're a pro? And
absolutely.
Of course.
I'm in my kingdom.
You're in your castle.
Your castle. Yeah.
I think as I've gone on and I've started to appreciate a little bit more golf course architecture, and I've started to appreciate the origins of the game and the history of the game, I've started to appreciate holes like that more and more. Like one of my favorite holes in world golf is the members 10th hole at Kingston Heath. It's like 120 yards, and you're standing there with a sand wedge in your hand, and you're like, if I don't hit this green, I'm going to make 5. Like, for me, those are great par threes. The postage stamp at Troon coming up for the Open this year. You could maybe say the 17th here at Sawgrass, it's a little contrived, but to me, the 12th hole at Augusta, for example, I think the short par threes where you've got a short iron in your hand, but it really makes you think and fearful of hitting a bad shot, those are the best par threes in the world.
What is it about RCD? You know, one of the things I was kind of taken aback on our visit was just like how simple the greens are. Like they're fairly flat. If you're on them, you feel like you have a pretty good chance of making putts. Yet, to me, it is about as stern of a test as you'll find. What about Royal County Down? When you think about it, you talked about how you needed to think through it, and really, what makes it so tough?
I think, yeah, as you said, if you hit the greens, it's you feel like you have a lot of chances, and the greens aren't. You know, there's some greens that are quite large, but others that aren't. But I think the trouble is hitting the greens, right? Like, you got the big runoff on the right of the second. You know, you've got the par 3/4, even the short par 4/6. Like, that second shot is difficult. You know, it's almost a little Donald Ross like in some ways. Like, the greens there, and again, it's sort of what Augusta does so well. You're standing in the middle of the fairway with a second shot, and it makes you think you have to do more than you have to do. You know, it gets you to play shots you don't want to play. And I think that's the, benchmark of a great golf course and great green complexes, is when it just makes you, second guess yourself a little bit over those second shots.
You talked about playing Baladas or tour professionals in junior golf. You've obviously seen these two sort of pillars of championship golf that this country miraculously has in top 5, 10, whatever courses you want to rank and you want to give them. How has equipment, the evolution of equipment in your lifetime, changed those two courses?
Yeah, if at all. I mean, it has. It certainly has. I think links courses more than ever need the elements to defend them. I think that's a given. I mean, I remember even that Walker Cup in 07, you know, the first hole is a pretty good par five, but you know, if it gets running down there, you know, but like, I remember, you know, having 7-iron in there as an 18-year-old, and that was, what was that, 07? So it was still like, you had Pro V1X and you know, you were playing a, you know, a pretty hot driver at that point. But I think, you know, they both, you know, as I said, they're both big golf courses. They both fortunately have had room to go back and on certain, you know, even Portrush has built 2 new holes for the Open. So, but you know, not all Lynx golf courses in Ireland or in the UK can do that. And, you know, fortunately, you know, these two have been able to do that because they're on pretty big pieces of land. But I think you can take a lot more bunkers out of play than previously. I would say, you know, at RCD, you know, you don't hit driver off 2, you don't hit driver off 3, you don't hit driver off 6. You know, there's a lot of holes where I think modern technology has almost taken, you know, it's taken the skill, like it's taken driving out of the equation a little bit on some holes at RCD, for example. And like the 13th hole, like as a prime example, like you'd much rather have to stand up there with a driver and hit it down that chute than just, you know, punch a little 2-iron down there because the golf ball goes a million miles.
With Portrush, how would you compare the test of Portrush and, you know, what makes that such a great championship course with Royal County Down?
So I think they're both tremendous championship golf courses. I think the benefit that Portrush has and the reason that it's able to host an Open Championship is because of the size of the property. So you think of the logistics and everything that need to go into hosting a major championship. You know, Portrush have most of that infrastructure there if they want it, where RCD doesn't. I would argue that RCD is a more challenging golf course, and I think it would probably provide a sterner test to professionals. But I just think Portrush has the infrastructure to host a huge event, and it is a hard golf course if you get strong winds and you get the right conditions. But if it's benign at Portrush, I mean, you can go low. And I just don't think, even if the conditions are benign at RCD, I just don't know if you can quite go as low there as Portrush.
They could go full LACC and just have, like, you know, a small gathering of fans for one at RCD.
Yeah, they could, but I don't think that's the RNA's. No. I don't think that's their thing. I think they like bringing golf to the masses, or at least that's what they tell us.
Can we do the cliche question, 10 rounds, how would you split them at RCD and Portrush? Everybody seems to ask this around here. 10 rounds, how would you split them?
So it's like, if I want a challenge, I go to RCD. If I want to enjoy myself, I go to Portrush. I would say 6 RCD, 4 Portrush.
All right.
Didn't go 5-5. I commend you for not going.
No, I'm not a fence sitter.
can we just add one more on the golf? Is there an under the radar course? There's like a bunch of good courses we've seen that you particularly enjoyed. You probably haven't played in a while, but maybe in club competitions or junior golf, aside from those two really high highly ranked pillars of the golf up here.
Yeah, you've coached her, you've done Castle Rock.
Well, we could have done it. I mean, though it's not something that we haven't seen yet. Anything in Northern Ireland,
really?
It's hard. Like, there's actually a couple of decent inland golf courses. It's near Belfast. I'd say Malone is decent for like an inland course. Beaver Park is pretty good. I think you've hit all the. I'm trying to think. Like, people are going to travel to Northern Ireland and want to play Lynx golf. I don't think they're going to want trees and what they can get where they're from. So,
What's your favorite Lynx course outside of the big two? Then,
my favorite Lynx course outside of the big two. It's not quite Northern Ireland. It's in the north of Ireland, but I would say Ballyliffin.
Yep,
Ballyliffin is really good. It's a really good golf course.
I've heard that that's a great golf course. That
there's two good golf courses there. So they have the Clachidi Links and they have the Old Links, and they're both very good. I would take a trip up there if you're ever back.
Last question about Portrush. Favorite hole? I'm just curious. There's so many out there that I loved.
I would say my favorite hole, Portrush, is it's the old 13th, but it's now the 15th, up over the crest of the hill, and then so it's the one before the really hard par 3. So I think it's 15.
Call
15.
Yeah, it's a great goal. I love the view. I love the second shot view. I think I've realized during this podcast I'm a big second shot guy. I like a golf course with good second shots.
Like it. Should we do speed round really quick? We did 10 rounds between RCD and Portrush. This is for Andy here. 10 rounds between RCD and Quail Hollow. How do you split them?
Oh. I like that North Carolina sunshine. I'll go, I'd probably go 6 Quail Hollow, 4 RCD.
No. Oh, God.
Not the answer Andy was looking for.
No.
Killing me. The tour pros just, they love Quail Hollow. Got so
You've
much
never
pushback.
Been. You need to set your feet on the ground there and actually experience it yourself.
All right, I got to ask: did you do a bunch of damage? We saw a video of you carrying a bunch of bags into Sawgrass last night. Did you do a bunch of damage in the Bay Hill Pro Shop?
I did not. That's just all my laundry.
Do they do the laundry? Is that like you bring it in and then do you play around and then you're back and it's done for you?
Yeah, pampered fucks.
Wow. They're a long way.
What's the best thing that the tour provides that the general fan doesn't know about for players? Like that makes your life way easier.
Yeah, like I think the laundry service is nice. Obviously the cars, the... free food I don't know, it's everything. I mean, there's not like there's honestly there is nothing to complain about.
Nothing. Seems like there's still more that could be had from what we understand, though, right? I mean, there's never enough.
In this world right now, I know there is never enough, but it is there's literally nothing. Like I my first year on tour in 07 or 08 on the European tour and flying from China to Korea to Malaysia to Singapore to Japan to the Middle East to whatever. Like, I mean, like it is like, and then I think about like just how convenient and how easy we have it nowadays. It's like, it's a different world.
Next, real quick speed round question. I don't know if it's just us looking particularly dopey, lumbering down Newcastle or Hollywood or Portrush, but how easy was it for you to pick out Americans or North Americans, tourists or golf tourists when you were kind of coming up? Was it easy?
It was very easy. Yeah.
What gave it away?
Easy. I don't know. I think Americans are like usually like just bigger people than Irish. It just bigger, louder, Florida.
Oh, God.
not saying that that's how everyone is, but I just think that, like, yeah, they, you sort of stand out a little bit.
Hey, what town, if you were going to take a vacation, let's just say it's not a golf vacation to Northern Ireland, you're gonna bring the family, what town would you most want to stay in?
Ooh, I'd say Portrush has got, like, a little bit more going on than, like, especially in the summertime. Like, I used to spend, so when my dad played in the north of Ireland at Portrush in the summers, there's, like, an amusement park in Portrush called Barry's. I used to spend all my time in Barry's. That was like my thing.
Yeah, it's a cool town. I thought Port Stewart was super cool too. It's like it's got a real nice, like, kind of energy, and it seems like the food and drink scene is gotten a lot better too. And there's some good places.
Yeah, there are. There's some really good restaurants in Portrush and in Port Stewart, and I think as well because they get a little bit more action from people coming from out of town. It makes that better anyways, I guess. But yeah, I would say for most people that, like, say are from Northern Ireland, if they were to have a holiday home in Northern Ireland, most people would have it in Portrush.
Do you think the Guinness tastes better here in Ireland?
So I think Guinness tastes shit everywhere. So
I was wondering.
So I'm not a big Guinness guy like you, Andy. Yeah. They say it does. Like, people that actually really like Guinness say that, you know, there's like a few different places even within Ireland that, like, there are like certain bars that are known for their Guinness more so than other ones. So there must be something. I don't know what it is, but I'm not a Guinness drinker. So,
all right. That's it. That's the final word. Final word.
Okay. We were gonna ask if it went in. Did that go in, Rory?
The 14th tee shot at Oak Hill.
Did it go in?
Do you know? Did that go in, Rory? Can you confirm? Oh. Did that go in?
Blocking. Oh my god.
Rory. Did that go in?
No, like, it didn't, Michael. People are just jumping up and down at the green for no reason.
All right.
They're jumping up and down because I missed the green by 20 yards to the right.
All right. Rory, thank you for your time. Really appreciate it.
No problem. No worries.